The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for another edition of Civics 101, a podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten or slept through in school. Today, we're talking about what have become two of the most powerful positions in a presidential cabinet, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, respectively. Some of you have asked about how the approaches and responsibilities of these departments and their heads function in our government. And our guide today is Linda Fowler. She's Professor Emeritus of Government and Chair in Policy Studies at Dartmouth College, author of several books, including most recently, Watchdogs on the Hill, The Decline of Congressional Oversight of U.S. Foreign Affairs from 1947 to 2008. Professor Fowler, welcome to Civics 101.
Well, I always can use a refresher. I had to do a little research before this show.
Oh, well, great. So everybody does. Glad to hear it. Before we get to the origins of the position, where are we now? Run through what the Department of State and the Secretary of State includes. What's under that purview?
Well, let's start with the Department of State, which includes all of the ambassadors, all of the administration for U.S. foreign aid programs that are not military aid. So this would be economic development, creation of civil organizations, assisting with development of political institutions, whole set of things like that. The main function is diplomacy. There are an awful lot of things that happen behind the scenes where the Secretary of State and undersecretaries are engaging with one-on-one conversations with their counterparts in other nations, sometimes with our enemies, sometimes with our friends, and basically trying to understand each other and figure out where they can find common agreement. So it's a very sensitive post. It requires, the department requires people who have deep knowledge of the areas that they're responsible for. They provide the support for the ambassadors, many of whom are political appointees, but many of whom are career diplomats. And the secretary provides a lot of confidential advice to the president.
All right, so that's the Department of State. How about the Department of Defense?
The Secretary of Defense is also a major advisor to the president. The Defense Department includes the departments of the Navy, the Army, the Air Force. The Navy, of course, includes the Marines, a variety of policy planning operations about procuring weapons, oversees a lot of the private contractors that the U.S. government is employing now to manage drones in warfare areas to engage in intelligence activities. And the secretary is responsible for coordinating activities among the Secretary of the Navy, the Secretary of the Air Force, and the Secretary of the Army. So it's an umbrella position, and it, of course, oversees a huge bureaucracy. The defense budget is probably $600 billion now. Compare that with the State Department budget, which is about 10 to 12. The budgets of the two departments were much closer back in the late 1940s when the U.S. engaged in massive economic aid to Europe under the Marshall Plan.
Well, let's go through that. Give us a little bit on the history of these two respective positions. When was the Secretary of State position established?
Well, we had a Secretary of State even before we were a nation, because somebody had to be in Paris to negotiate the peace treaty to end the Revolutionary War. The first one was John Jay. And then he was followed by Thomas Jefferson. A number of the Secretaries of State have become president, whether it's James Madison, James Monroe, James Buchanan. So it's an venerable position. It was has been extraordinarily important throughout our history up until recent times. And the reason for that is the United States was in peril after the Revolutionary War. We had the British patrolling the seas and occupying northern Canada. We had the French in Canada and on our western border in what became the Louisiana Territory, and the French and the Spanish on our southern border. And we had a very weak military. And indeed, the framers didn't want to have a standing army. They feared that a standing army would be utilized to waste taxpayers' money and engage in unnecessary military interventions. So they put a lot of emphasis on diplomacy. And that held true, really, up until probably the last couple of decades.
When was the Secretary of Defense position established?
That was established in the late 1940s as a reform enacted by Republicans after they gained control of Congress in 1947. And they had promised to restore some balance to the government by strengthening Congress and bringing the president to heel after a long war. The Secretary of Defense was set up to ensure civilian control over the military and to put an end to the wasteful rivalries among the various war departments, the Army, the Navy, and what came to be the Air Force.
But civilian control, tell us more about that. This is something that did come up after Donald Trump named the retired four-star Marine Corps General James Mattis as his pick for defense because he was considered the retired. He'd been in the military very actively fairly recently.
Well, as part of the creation of this position, because it was to impose civilian control, there's a restriction that no general may occupy the office unless he or she has been out of uniform for 7 years. Now, there was an exception made for General George Marshall, who was one of the chief architects of the World War II effort and a major player in constructing the post-war policies of containment. And so he was given an exemption, and that's the only one we've had until General Mattis.
I'm speaking with Linda Fowler. She's professor emeritus of government at Dartmouth College. We're getting some insight into the respective roles and histories of the Department of State and the Department of Defense. So the Secretary of State is now fourth in line of succession after the president. The Secretary of Defense is the sixth. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more about the difference in their approaches. And traditionally, there has been some tension between the two spheres of influence. Thinking of more recently, Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, and then Condoleezza Rice under George W. Bush. Are they, these two positions, by their very nature, oppositional?
Well, yes, and that's actually healthy. It's best if the president hears competing views about how the U.S. should respond to a crisis. In this current world where the U.S. is the superpower and is expected to and sees itself as having interests all around the globe, there are always debates about whether one should send a destroyer or an aircraft carrier or insert special forces or try to settle disputes diplomatically. So a good example would be General Eisenhower's handling of the situation with China, where the Chinese were threatening to seize two islands, Quemoy and Matsu. And there were huge debates about whether the U.S. should intervene militarily against China, having been in war with China over Korea. And so they engaged in diplomacy and saber rattling. The president sent ships to sort of demonstrate resolve, but at the same time, there were major talks going on behind the scenes. And that's often how major international crises happen. Particularly in the nuclear era, you don't want to confuse your enemy. You don't want to send the wrong signals or have them misunderstand the signals. So diplomacy is really important, but we tend to dismiss it because we don't see it. And if it's successful, we really don't see it because the bad thing didn't happen.
Well, I think of it as those sort of quiet conversations in hushed rooms with lots of drapery, you know. And one of my colleagues came up with a great analogy for it. Like if you look at a cop show, you've got a tense situation and then you've got a negotiator there who's trying to talk down the person who's holding the hostages. And they're saying, no, give me more time to talk this out. And the SWAT team saying, no, we're going in there. Does that analogy actually work for the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense?
I think that's a good one. And the Secretary of Defense's job is basically to outline the alternatives. This is what we could reasonably expect to achieve with force at this particular level of force. Here's the risk we assign to that outcome. With more force, we might increase the probability, but we would also raise the costs. And we're always at the risk of diminishing U.S. prestige if we intervene militarily and it fails. So what these two secretaries are doing is trying to communicate to the president what are the costs and benefits of an array of policies that the president could adopt. And both of these secretaries, of course, work closely with the president's national security advisor in the White House and also with the CIA director.
Well, now we in the current administration, we have a political outsider as Secretary of State in Rex Tillerson. And then we have General Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, as he is often called, as the Secretary of Defense. So two people who haven't served in the government traditionally, the case has been made that because they are outsiders, they have more of those kind of out-of-the-box kind of ideas and solutions. How do you look at that current configuration?
I think out-of-the-box is greatly overrated when you're dealing with complicated international issues. And I'll just put my bias out there. There are a lot of ideas that haven't been adopted that have been considered in the past, and they haven't been adopted because they're actually, they should be in the box. and so having continuity and having experienced people, I think, is very important. But I don't consider General Mattis to be an outsider. He's been stationed in the Pentagon. That's an enormous bureaucracy. He's had interactions with the National Security Council and with both President Obama and President Bush. So generals aren't outsiders. He is known to be outspoken and known to be willing to deliver bad news. He came to my class a couple of years ago, right after he'd retired. Yeah, and he lived up to his reputation. I found him terrific with the students. He was engaging. He was forthright. He was extremely impressive. But outsider is not the word I would use. I would say in many ways, Secretary Tillerson is also not an outsider in the conventional world. The oil company he ran is a global player. They have operations in Africa, in the Middle East, in Latin America, in all over the place. And many of these of the countries where the company is dealing, trying to extract oil, they have to deal directly with governments, and often these governments are not very stable. So I would say he's probably more knowledgeable about international affairs than he's probably been given credit for. So he's not an amateur in the way that our president is.
Professor Fowler, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Linda Fowler is Professor Emeritus of Government at Dartmouth College and author of several books, most recently Watchdogs on the Hill. It's about the decline of congressional oversight of America's foreign affairs from 1947 to 2008.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A New Hampshire lawmaker again made national and international headlines when the Daily Beast unmasked Robert Fisher, a Republican state representative from Laconia, as the architect of the red pill page of the Reddit website. Among the posts on the site advocating for men's rights are tips on how men can protect themselves from being accused of, quote, false rape, and a post considering how enjoyable rape must be from the perspective of a rapist. The revelation prompted lawmakers from both sides of the aisle to demand that Fisher step down. He has refused. For others, it was a glimpse of the wide, seemingly infinite variety of subreddits. Brady Carlson is host of All Things Considered for Wisconsin Public Radio. He's going to explain what a subreddit even is. Hello, Brady.
Hi there.
Okay, so how about a Reddit primer?
Sure. Well, Reddit starts in 2005, and originally it started as a way to share and identify the most trending links and stories online. Remember, this was a time when you had sites like Dig and Delicious, social bookmarking applications where everybody was trying to post a hot new link, and Reddit was trying to centralize that function. But it very quickly became more than a bookmarking site for people to post links on. They started adding other features like comments. You could vote up or down on a link or a comment that you liked. And they added what's known as subreddits, basically sub-forums, so that people who wanted to focus on sports or politics or books or whatever the topic was could focus on the links just in that topic. There's not just the red pill on Reddit. There are other subreddits on that topic, and there are multiple subreddits on multiple topics.
Okay, let's get into some of those in a minute, but I wanted to know if Reddit officially hosts a subreddit. Is this all just started by users?
They're all proposed, submitted, and run by users. They manage the look and feel of the site. The moderators are all volunteers. Reddit staff will step in from time to time, especially when there's a real high-profile scandal, one that maybe will cost them investors or advertisers. But the idea is really that this is a community-run platform, and the community tends to step up and do that. The Reddit people, their official slogan is the front page of the internet, and that's accurate for what they intended to be. Today, I think of it more like a front door to the internet. Virtually every kind of culture, subculture that's online has a corner on Reddit.
Which means that there are some really funny things like, you know, Reddit's all with little bits of films of cats being scared and funny. And let's see, another one, pictures of outlets in weird places. I mean, there's a lot of random Reddits, but there is also a lot of really caustic stuff. Pizzagate, the conspiracy theory linking Hillary Clinton to a child sex ring supposedly run out of a Washington, D.C. pizzeria that led to somebody going to check it out himself with a gun, started on Reddit.
You're absolutely right. Controversy is not new for Reddit. This is also the site that hosted that infamous group that thought that it would find the identity of the Boston Marathon bombers before police did. It had a huge subreddit focused on the celebrity photo hack, the explicit photos that came out a few years ago. It seems like every couple of years there's kind of a flare-up on Reddit that winds up being tamped down. And, of course, I'm sure that the same philosophy that runs a lot of the discussions on the Red Pill subreddit are very much like what we saw during the Gamergate movement, where you had groups of people who were making threats and harassing women in the video game industry over unproven allegations against women in the video game industry who faced threats and harassment as a result.
Okay, so how does Reddit, which I guess creates the mantle or the framing for these front doors to the internet, how does it handle these kinds of concerns?
Roughly as well or as not well as any of the major social media platforms. Again, their theory is to keep content and conversation as free as possible, to sort of let it unfold and people are able to police themselves. A lot of the idea in the mechanism of Reddit is that if someone says something that's really untoward or offensive, that voters will use their ratings button to downvote them, it's called. And at a certain level, then things that get a lot of negative votes will be hidden from the forum. But that's the theory. In practice, the Reddit team has actually come in and shut down a few subreddits. There was a famous subreddit called Jailbait, and you can imagine what kinds of content people were sharing on that. User backlash can prompt Reddit to shut down a subreddit over content. Sometimes groups have tried to game the front page of Reddit, which shows the most popular and the most trending topics. Maybe during an election, they try to bump up their candidates' posts, and Reddit will occasionally shut that kind of thing down. I mean, it's a company that has investors and advertisers. They don't want groups scaring them away because of untoward activity online.
But so why go there? Why even open the floodgates?
Because the rest of the floodgates is typically very fun. There's always awful stuff on Reddit, but there is much more fun stuff if you search around a bit. Mainstream Reddit culture is, I think, what makes it the most exciting. And this is not necessarily something that a thin-skinned person is going to enjoy that much. There's a lot of teasing and a lot of roasting. It's not quite harassment or mocking in the same way that you see in other parts of Reddit. But, you know, this is a legitimate community. People have fun with each other in a way that they don't do on sites that don't have this structure, this subreddit idea. There was a project a few months ago called Reddit Place. It was sort of an April Fool's joke that the company put on, but they gave users essentially a blank canvas to draw on. They said you could draw one pixel at a time, then you have to wait to add another pixel yourself. So what people did was they turned to their communities and they said, let's draw a picture together. And what eventually came out of it was this enormous mural that represented the different subreddits, the logos, the community memes that people on Reddit talk about together. It really was a nice job of representing what Reddit means to its users and its subreddits.
So when you say mainstream Reddit, that is different from the subreddits. Is that how you're the distinction?
Mainstream Reddit culture is sort of the main conventions that people use in discussing and interacting with each other. So there's a sort of lighthearted, sarcastic, snarky feel that goes along with it. People will have running gags that can last, you know, through an entire post and may go in a totally different direction than what the original poster intended. I don't want to say it's lighthearted because it can get wild in there, but there's a lot of snark that goes on.
So what are some of your favorite places to go on Reddit, your subreddits?
Well, I always encourage people to start on a subreddit called Ask Reddit, which, like it sounds, is a place where people will post a question and then try to get people to discuss it. So it could be as simple as, what's the weirdest reason you've ever seen somebody get fired from a job? And with the right question, you'll find some truly amazing stories. I think my favorite Ask Reddit moment was when somebody made a Seinfeld reference. You know, the character George Costanza is always getting fired in odd ways because of nitpicky moments. They said, what's the most George Costanza reason that you ever saw someone break up or get fired from a job? And the stories were just outrageous and hilarious, and one story would feed off of another. It was truly amazing. This was also, this week marked the 5-year anniversary of the confession thread on Ask Reddit.
Uh-huh.
If you just say the confession thread on Reddit, people will know what you're talking about. People were posting their deepest secrets, people saying, you know, I'm responsible. I was a landlord. I was responsible for a gas leak that killed my tenants. Or people would say, you know, I'm living a lie. My credentials are completely fabricated. Or I'm a person who makes safety devices and I hear voices and I don't know that people should trust me to do that. Truly, truly amazing, captivating stories coming out of Ask Reddit. There's a subreddit called Awe, which is just cute animal pictures. There was a picture on there a few weeks ago of a baby kangaroo wearing a big green diaper at a rehabilitation facility, and that's just about the cutest thing you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I like a lot of the subreddits that focus on loops or animated GIFs. There's one I like called WCGW, which stands for What Could Go Wrong? So it's fail loops, you know. We decided to put hydrogen in our balloons instead of helium. What could go wrong? And you see them catch on fire and people freaking out. There's another one that I like called Perfect Loops, which is for animations and optical illusions that look as if they go on forever with no starting or stopping points.
So that sounds like there's a lot of good there, a lot to keep an eye on. How do you navigate it?
You have to do a little bit of hunting around, I find. One thing people will often do is it's sort of the Reddit equivalent of retweeting. They will do what's called cross-posting. So If there's a great video in perfect loops, you might also see it in one of the other loop subreddits. And so you start to see where that goes. Reddit is also good at providing links for people to discover new Reddits. You'll see posts from all over the site that are trending. You might find it there. You'll also find a link to other subreddits that people are discovering. And also you can just do a plain search, and oftentimes that's how I encounter new subreddits. And I've picked up quite a few tips from the bowling subreddit, especially about like how to pick the right bowling ball for somebody who may not quite know what he's doing yet. And the established communities can handle that. They even sometimes write up guides to their topics.
I was just thinking about that, Brady, because I was bowling in Portland, Oregon last week. And, you know, I was raised on candlepins. These heavy balls have me thrown.
And they've got the whole thing down. You know, they pick up on this. I'm sure there's a candlepin subreddit on there for you, too.
I'm sure there is. But, okay, so in just cruising around Reddit a little bit before I spoke to you, I did hit random, and it shows me some stuff that are crazy, interesting Reddits. But you really can go down a rabbit hole. So can we blame you if for all of the lost hours that we will spend on Reddit?
Yes, and I blame the Redditors for all the lost hours that I've had. For example, I spend a lot of time on a subreddit called Listen to This. That's where I pick up new bands these days. And not everyone I listen to on there is great, but I've picked up more winners than losers over the years, and it's a huge time suck, but a really nice one. And a lot of the news that I pick up, I picked up legitimate news stories for my job just by keeping an eye on the Wisconsin Reddit page, on the New Hampshire Reddit page when I lived there, and I pick up a lot of fun stories that I like to share with people on a subreddit called Not the Onion. These are stories that are so bananas that they sound like the people from The Onion wrote them, like gin recalled for having too much alcohol. I don't want to use the old cliche that there's something for everyone on Reddit, but there kind of is. If you hunt around for it enough, you'll find some things that really fit you.
Brady Carlson, host of All Things Considered for Wisconsin Public Radio, thank you so much for, I guess, giving us the gateway to Reddit.
My pleasure.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Something's embedded in the stomach lining. Looks like a microchip.
A clip there from NCIS New Orleans, one of several crime procedurals that have made death, gore, and gristle common on television. With their spunky pathologists and well-lit labs, these shows reduce the emotional freight of death to just blood, bone, and tissue. What they don't do is prepare even seasoned viewers for the shock of facing real corpses during a real autopsy. Rachel Wilkinson attended an autopsy at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and wrote about it for The Atlantic. And Rachel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you end up in an autopsy room at UPMC?
Well, I was actually in a medical writing class. It was not easy. I didn't start out, in other words, sort of planning to go to an autopsy, but I met the full-time hospital pathologist at UPMC, Dr. Jeffrey Nine. I met him, and within the span of about 5 minutes, he said really reverent, beautiful things about his job, and then at the same time sort of made a really funny joke. And I thought, okay, there's something weird going on in this room where they're navigating between the sacred and the profane, and I knew I wanted to get in and see it. So I did sort of a dry run where I saw the room and there was nobody there, and then I went when they didn't have a case, and then they got me in to see an actual case.
So that's a teaching hospital, correct?
Correct.
How often do they conduct autopsies at UPMC?
Because it's not like NCIS, so it's not homicides. It's whenever someone has a relative die in the system and the next of kin elects to have that autopsy performed. So it comes out to about one a day, a little less, or about 350 a year.
Well, they are part of the formula on many police and crime shows. So what are some of the ways that autopsies as seen on TV differ from the real thing?
A forensic autopsy, you're trying very hard to sort of look at it from a legal perspective, and it usually has to be done quickly, and you're trying to get information out, sometimes to to lawyers, to other doctors, whoever. Whereas hospital autopsy, they assume the cause isn't homicide. And so in a big teaching hospital like UPMC, they take a lot more time. Mm-hmm. So on NCIS, they can do 40 minutes an hour per autopsy, and you're going to have multiple bodies per day coming in. But the one a day of just sort of natural causes in the hospital system, they can take their time. And because it's students working, they can take up to 6 hours to do that.
Wow. Were you the only person there attending for the first time?
Yes.
So students are usually, they're pretty well seasoned in this. Did you get any warning or tips for how to prepare?
I was told it's totally acceptable to faint, and that trained professionals, medical students, everybody faints. And so to be prepared for whatever natural reaction my body was going to have. And some of the really new people, they told me the smell is sometimes the hardest part. So they will wear like Vaseline under their noses. I said, no, I'm going to do it all in, all natural. And it wasn't as bad as I thought.
And you didn't faint.
Didn't faint.
Did you know anything about the identity of the person that you were witnessing the autopsy on?
Because of privacy reasons, they kind of wanted to hide his identity as much as possible. So basically all I knew was his general age range, his time of death, and what they thought the cause of death would be. But other than that, I didn't know his family, his job, where he was from, any of that.
You know, they put, something over a sheet or something to cover his face during the autopsy. Do they normally do that, or was that just for your purposes?
You know, I was thinking about that, actually. I think it was in deference to me, but I don't know if they suddenly realized, like, oh, there's this visitor in the room and maybe we should defer to her, or if it maybe is something they do in some cases. It was such a lovely moment that I kind of didn't ask at the time.
A lovely moment. What do you mean?
The interesting thing, I think, is when you step into the room, everything is immediately routinized. It's hard in some ways to have an emotional reaction because everybody is at work doing their jobs, running around. And so everything is kind of scientific and accounted and present for. But then there are these little moments where you realize, oh, like, here's what we're actually doing. And so they were very much in the middle of just procedure and talking and teaching. And it all seemed, in this strange way, very ordinary and banal. And then suddenly we're called back into the reality of, oh, this is a person. This is a dead body in the room with a face. Mm-hmm. And so when they did that, it was this really nice act, I felt, that paid homage to where we were. And then immediately after that, we were kind of back in the investigation part of it. And the oscillation between those two things is what I found so fascinating.
Many of us have witnessed autopsies in quotes on programs like NCIS or other crime procedurals. Well, I'm speaking with Rachel Wilkinson, who attended one for real at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and wrote about it for The Atlantic magazine. Well, your description of Dr. Jeffrey Nine, he's the pathologist that was conducting the autopsy you attended. I don't know, it almost made him sound like one of those TV characters, you know, throwing out really good one-liners 1 minute and then expert analysis the next. What was he like as a guide?
He was exactly like that. Extremely competent and could jump in and do anything. And yet he clearly was trying to keep it, you know, it seems almost crass to say like fun and light for the students, but there was an element of that. And then a fun fact about him that did not make it into the article is he is also a seminarian.
Really?
He is, I think, a Presbyterian minister on the weekends. And so another pathology stereotype is that they're kind of low on emotional intelligence, but he's actually known for being incredibly empathetic and communicative with families. So he can wear so many hats. And so he's, needless to say, really fantastic at his job and navigating all those different things.
Well, pathologists also have a rap, I think, for being, you know, a little bit creepy. You know, somehow their work is macabre or kept underground. What did you learn about their work?
I mean, I think I came to sympathize with them that I had no idea what a pathologist was beforehand, and then came to realize how essential they are to the medical profession and also how hidden. Because it is true that if the person biopsying a cancer sample and telling you whether it's cancer or not is them, just behind the scenes, who you may or may not talk to. So I came to appreciate that they're incredibly knowledgeable and they have to know everything, and yet we don't we don't see them as much as we maybe could.
An autopsy is like the best anatomy lesson one could ever attend. Did it change the way that you understand the human body?
You know, it's strange. It kind of did. By the end of this, and I was not expecting this at all, I mean, I was holding organs. But it's strange to see a liver on the table, because now whenever I like have a drink or something, I can imagine myself so much more clearly as an embodied person who's finite, you know, who has like an end date. And they all told me this too, that the cliche is true, that they all feel more connected to life by virtue of the fact that they see death all the time.
Do autopsies just become run of the mill?
They do, because it's your day in, day out job, and you have, you know, a script that you follow. But at the same time, there are these moments that they never really completely get past, where you realize this is a person on the table and I'm confronting my own mortality. I kind of got them to speak about what brings them back to that sacred place. And they said it's things like when a body comes on the table and it has fingernail polish or a tattoo. And so those little tiny personal things are the things that kind of bring them out of this scientific space and back into the space of life.
It's so interesting. Is it an experience that you'd recommend to anyone else if they have the chance to witness an autopsy?
It's strange to say that I would, because it did change me in a way. And I do like think about it from time to time. We live in a culture now where death, talking about death, you know, any of the ugliness of death is particularly taboo and hidden. Even 100 years ago here in downtown Pittsburgh, where the morgue used to be, they used to have a plate glass window where they display bodies on the slab. And it was for people to ID victims. That was the stated purpose. But allegedly, people would like come by with their prom dates to look at the bodies.
Wowie.
Yeah. And this was true in pretty much all major cities, you know, at the end of the 19th century. Like the Paris morgue was also infamous for this. And so it's really been stripped away from the public space like that. And so they feel privileged to be kind of close to that, because it's something that is locked away now. And they're sort of almost the last keeper of it. And so to get to sit in on that when it's something that we just, I mean, I guess we do on NCIS, but in a sort of not fictionalized way, interact with it. It was a privilege to get to see that along with them.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for sharing that experience with us.
Oh, thank you.
Rachel Wilkinson, she's a Pittsburgh-based writer who wrote about attending an autopsy for The Atlantic. You can find a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came from Broke for Free, Ari De Niro, Revolution Void, and Jason Leonard. Lots more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org or on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio, on Twitter at Word of Mouth, and you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play for the podcast. If you like the podcast, please review it on iTunes, which will help other people to find us, because everything goes so much further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.